This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 4th of July, these are our main stories. The Lebanese militant group Hezbollah has launched a new barrage of cross-border fire at Israel over Wednesday's killing of a senior Hezbollah commander. President Biden meets leading Democrats at the White House as he fights for his political life after his faltering debate performance last week. Strong winds and heavy rain hit the Cayman Islands as Hurricane Beryl makes its way towards the coast of Mexico. Also in this podcast...
Has she inherited this from you and your wife?
Not really. We don't play chess at all.
Really? You don't play?
This is completely happened accidentally.
The 9-year-old girl who is now England's youngest international chess star. We start this podcast in northern Israel. This was the sound on Thursday across one of the world's most volatile borders as a Lebanese militant group, Hezbollah, fired more than 200 rockets and explosive drones in retaliation for Israel's killing of one of its senior commanders a day earlier. The land in northern Israel and southern Lebanon is tinder dry, ready to be consumed by the sparks that fly on an almost daily basis between these two sworn enemies. A concern for all those who watch this region and fear the cross-border exchanges could erupt into a full-blown war, not just between a heavily armed Hezbollah and Israel, but also drawing in Hezbollah's backer, Iran. Iran also supports Hamas, which earlier said it had sent ideas to Qatari and Egyptian mediators aimed at ending its war with Israel. For its part, Israel has confirmed that it's, in its words, evaluating what it describes as Hamas's new comments on a ceasefire and hostage deal. I got more on all this with our Middle East correspondent, Yoland Nell, first on the latest barrage across the Israel-Lebanon border.
This is the latest surge in violence in what is really a steadily worsening conflict across the Israel-Lebanese border. This barrage of rockets, Hezbollah said more than 200 fired, as well as 20 attack drones sent, was retaliation for the killing of this top Hezbollah commander, Mohammad Nasser, a day ago. He was killed in an airstrike in Tyre. And the Israeli military says only really that a number of the incoming rockets were intercepted by air defense and its fighter jets for the drones. And we're not hearing any reports of injuries on the Israeli side, although certainly there have been several fires that have been started as a result of all this. Now, the Lebanese National News Agency has been saying that there were Israeli jets that then broke the sound barrier over parts of Lebanon. They've been in response to all of this hitting what they described the Israeli military as Hezbollah military structures in southern Lebanon.
And meanwhile, as fighting continues to rage in Gaza, Hamas says it has sent new ideas to mediators on how to end its war with Israel. Is this likely to be any more successful than previous such statements?
I mean, really, it's just not clear yet if this is going to lead to some kind of a breakthrough. We've had so many failed efforts to bring about a new ceasefire and hostage release deal. But what we're hearing, Hamas has said it's responded in a positive spirit to the deal that's on the table, essentially this three-phase plan that President Biden's been pushing, saying that it came from the Israeli side. The Israeli Prime Minister's office said very quickly it was evaluating this and would get back to the mediators. We're hearing reports that the Israeli Security Cabinet is supposed to discuss the Hamas comments later, and also that we understand that the Israeli Prime Minister is going to speak to the US President Joe Biden as well later in the day, and of course this will be a main subject. It's really been the Qataris, the Egyptians in the region, and then the US as well that have been leading the mediation effort here. In the Israeli media, if you look, there's some guarded optimism that's being expressed. One of the Israeli newspapers quoting an unnamed Israeli official saying that Hamas is no longer demanding that there should be a full ceasefire in the first stage of the deal. We've had that confirmed to us from a Palestinian official who's involved in the talks, saying, though, that there are also new conditions Hamas has added about the withdrawal of Israeli forces from this strategically important strip of land between Israel and Egypt, the Philadelphia corridor, including the Rafah border crossing. And so we have to see what the Israelis make of that. They say they're going to get back to the mediators with their response on the response.
Yoland Nell. Well, 9 months into the Gaza war, there are increasing signs of open dissent against Hamas, despite fear of its often brutal reprisals against those who dare to speak out against it. Residents have told the BBC that people are publicly cursing the group's leaders and that some are publishing messages online urging them to agree to a ceasefire. Many in Gaza are still fiercely loyal to Hamas, and support for the October the 7th attacks is still high. But as our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson reports, anger against the group is growing.
In Gaza now, the anger is not just against Israel, but against Hamas. Scenes like this, unthinkable before the war, are growing more common. Enough killing, damn you, this university teacher screams. You're scum. This leadership does not represent us. It does not represent us. The teacher was filmed after hundreds of Palestinians were killed and injured in an Israeli raid to rescue hostages last month. Some have openly criticized Hamas for hiding the hostages in a busy marketplace or firing rockets from civilian areas. Amin publicly opposed Hamas before the war and was arrested by its security forces several times. Now, he says, people are less afraid to speak out.
In Gaza, most people criticise what Hamas has done. Some people are even calling their livestock by the names of certain Hamas leaders. It has a lot of support amongst those outside Gaza's borders, who are sitting under air conditioners in their comfortable homes, who have not lost a child, a home, a future, a leg.
Desperation is eroding social control in Gaza. There are those still fiercely loyal to Hamas, and it's hard to assess how many of them are turning away. But even some on the group's own payroll are wavering. One senior Hamas official, speaking anonymously to the BBC, said the 7th of October attacks were a crazy, uncalculated leap with a devastating impact on Gaza's people.
I know from my work with the Hamas government that it prepared well for the attack militarily, but they did not build any safe shelters for people or reserve enough food, fuel and medical supplies. If my family and I survive this war, I will leave Gaza the first chance I get.
Hamas is battling for control on the streets. Its police targeted by Israeli forces. Unofficial security squads have been filmed punishing looters. And a well-placed source described bloody score settling with other armed groups in places where Israel's army had withdrawn. Before the war, Gaza's sharp political divisions were largely hidden under a blanket of fear. But fear is only relative to what you have to lose.
That report by Lucy Williamson. The US President Joe Biden is fighting for his political life as calls grow for him to drop out of the 2024 presidential race following his dismal debate performance against Donald Trump a week ago. After a few senior Democrats publicly started to voice concerns that many have harboured in private about the 81-year-old's mental sharpness, Mr. Biden held an emergency meeting with Democratic governors at the White House. After the meeting, the governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, said she'd been encouraged by what she'd heard from the president.
I'm here to tell you today, President Joe Biden is in it to win it. And all of us said we pledged our support to him because the stakes could not be higher. On the eve of the 4th of July celebration, we talk about how we transition under a monarchy and a tyranny that our founding fathers fought against, that we risk right now descending back into that very same place. We will stand with the president as we fight that force being Donald Trump.
But big donors are also turning against Mr. Biden as calls increase for him to release more of his medical records. A new opinion poll shows that Mr. Trump's lead over Mr. Biden has widened since the debate. With more, here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
The line from the White House is very clear. Joe Biden has said in a call to campaign staff, and it's gone out in a fundraising communication, no one is pushing me out. I am not quitting. And he has started now making phone calls and having meetings with senior party figures in Congress and also with those governors who he had into the White House. And to all of them as well, he is saying, I am the candidate and I'm committed to fighting on. But of course, he's talking to them about what concerns they've heard from voters, trying to allay the worries that they have, because there is panic rising in the Democratic Party for sure. One of the things people are not very happy about is quite how long it has taken him to get in touch with them to try to reassure them. That debate was on Thursday night. It's Tuesday when he first started directly, personally speaking to people to try and set their fears at rest. And the explanations he's offering as to why he performed so poorly in the debate, they're not terribly convincing. He's saying that he was jet-lagged and tired after two trips to Europe, and that was why he got so confused on stage. Well, he'd been back for 12 days before the debate. He'd had a week up at Camp David resting and preparing for the debate. The idea that he hadn't got over his foreign travel just frankly seems a bit ridiculous. So although publicly almost all of the party are still backing him, and all of those governors came out of that meeting saying he has our support, what he's doing to try to reassure them isn't necessarily working, and there's real pressure on him to get out there and demonstrate to voters that he has got what it takes to be president. That's what he needs to do in the next few days if he's to retain support. There are no men in grey suits, as they used to be called in British politics, who can come into the Oval Office and tell him, the game's up, Joe, it's time to step aside. But he is the one who has cast this election as existential for American democracy. He says basically the republic is on the line in this election, and think carefully about who you choose to vote for as a result. Having set the stakes that high, it's harder and harder for a candidate who looks like he's losing to maintain that he has to be the one who goes into the election. And it is Joe Biden who cast it in those terms. But at the end of the day, he's the one who has to make the decision.
Sarah Smith. A boat financed by the artist and political activist Banksy has been seized by the Italian authorities after it was involved in rescuing dozens of people from the Mediterranean Sea, according to its crew. The anonymous street artist has called the move vile and unacceptable on social media. Stephanie Prentice has this report.
His identity may be hidden, but when it comes to his stance on migrants, the artist Banksy has always been out in the open. Just last week, an installation of his was filmed jolting across the tops of the crowds at Glastonbury Festival in England, a rubber dinghy full of mannequins shrouded in fabric. Now, Banksy is criticising the Italian government, accusing it of impounding his rescue boat, the Louise Michel. The 30-metre-long white and pink vessel operates around the Mediterranean Sea, taking people out of small boats and escorting them to land. Its crew say it was during one of these missions that they moored at the port of Lampedusa with 37 migrants on board, 17 of them children, but the authorities had ordered them to Sicily. Writing on X, the crew said the sea was too rough to follow orders and that as a punishment, the boat will be grounded for 20 days. Italy's right-wing government has faced criticism in the past for restricting charity rescue ships, including accusations of orders to take migrants to distant ports and away from rescue centres. And it's not the first time the Louise Michel has been stopped. It was detained last March after responding to a distress call, which authorities at the time said violated protocols. This time, the Louise Michel's crew has called grounding the boat a political game.
Stephanie Prentice. The British wildlife charity, the RSPB, says a pair of white-tailed eagles has astounded experts by foregoing their opportunity to breed this year so that they can look after a chick that was injured last year. In a rare display of parental care, the two eagles on the Isle of Mull in Scotland are continuing to nurse the injured chick into its second year of life. Here's our science correspondent, Victoria Gill.
It's a story with a stormy beginning. The white-tailed eagle chick injured its left wing in July of last year when the nest fell to the ground in unseasonably wild weather on the Isle of Mull. The island's RSPB officer, who monitors the birds, didn't hold out much hope for its survival. But this spring, it was spotted alive in a new nest and being fed fish by its parents. A wildlife photographer has now captured footage of the young eagle in flight. It has an obvious lump in its wing, which appears to be the bulge of a healed broken bone. White-tailed eagle chicks normally hatch in April, fledge in July, and by October are starting to fend for themselves. The RSPB says this pair have skipped this year's breeding season to tend to their injured year-old chick. The charity says this extended parental care is unprecedented for these birds of prey.
Victoria Gill. Still to come in this podcast.
We're basically seeing scams being done using deepfake videos, people being called by family members or police officers, and basically not able to determine whether that's the real person or not.
Chinese people around the world are being targeted by an elaborate phone scam in which criminals pretend to be police or relatives. As we record this global news podcast, one of the strongest storms to hit the Caribbean in years is bringing heavy rain and winds to the Cayman Islands. Earlier, it left a trail of devastation as it hurtled along the southern coast of Jamaica. That's the sound of winds of more than 230 kilometres per hour. At least one person is known to have died in Jamaica, taking the death toll in the Caribbean to at least seven so far. Carriacou is said to be one of the islands most devastated by Hurricane Beryl. It's off the coast of mainland Grenada and is home to 6,000 people. Despite most phone communications being cut off, a tourist official, Rena Mills, managed to call the BBC by driving to the far side of Carriacou to connect with one of the few still functioning phone masts on the nearby mainland.
There were only 3 to 4 houses that were spared in my village. So my uncle's house, it's gone. My brother's house is gone. My sister's house is gone. My house is gone. Another sister of mine's house is gone. And all of us, we are currently at my brother. So it's about 20 of us in that small house.
Well, as the hurricane has moved away from Jamaica, the islanders have begun assessing the damage there. Our correspondent, Nick Davis, is in the Jamaican capital, Kingston.
The thing which has been exactly what I expected was this band of rain, and it's just been constant and barely not stopping throughout the most of the day. And I think that's where we're going to see a lot of the damage which has been done to Jamaica, not by the sort of almost devastating force of the storm, but what's been happening during this rainfall. Because we have so many near misses within the region, you know, the storms will, you know, veer left or right, northeast, southwest. People tend to, well, you know, it may hit us, it may not hit us, and they tend to stay in place, you know, which is kind of part of the information which is told. But yeah, low-lying areas, people need to get out. People often go to shelters set up by the government, set up by, you know, the disaster preparedness organizations. But some people don't like that. Some people don't like chucked up against people they don't know, away from their homes, not knowing what's happening in their homes. You know, they prefer to risk literally death than not knowing what's happening to their property.
Nick Davis in Kingston. The storm is expected to hit southeast Mexico by the end of the week. Police in northern India have arrested 6 organisers of a prayer meeting where a crush led to the deaths of more than 120 people. Officials say the 4 men and 2 women who've been detained were key aides of Suraj Pal Singh, a former police constable who became a self-styled Indian guru and changed his name to Narayan Sakahari. Our South Asia correspondent Ambarasa Natarajan reports from Delhi.
Police in Uttar Pradesh said all those arrested were volunteers of the religious group of the self-styled guru Narayan Sakahari, a former police officer turned spiritual leader. They said the 6 were involved in crowd management of the sermon attended by tens of thousands of people on Tuesday. The preacher, known as Bole Baba, has not been seen in public since the disaster, but his lawyer earlier said he was in his ashram in the state. The spiritual leader has not been named in the initial police complaint. His lawyer blamed antisocial elements for the crush without elaborating.
Ambarasan Etirajan. Chinese people around the world are being targeted by an elaborate phone scam in which criminals pretend to be Chinese police. A British Chinese woman has told the BBC how she handed over her life savings in the belief that she was paying bail in order to avoid extradition to China on fabricated criminal charges. As Elaine Chong reports, the scammers go to extraordinary lengths to trick their victims.
Early one Sunday last summer, Helen Young was woken by the phone ringing. Helen, who is an accountant in London, thought it was her mother in China, but it wasn't.
Miss Young? Are you Miss Young? I said, yes, what can I do for you?
The voice on the line told Helen that he was a customs officer in China. An illegal parcel had been sent in Helen's name, he said. But Helen hadn't sent anything. And when she was told the call was being transferred to the police, she was sceptical.
How do I know you're real police? Switch on WhatsApp. We can connect. So he connected me that moment.
When they went on a video call, Helen saw a uniformed man. He flashed a police ID that said he was called Officer Fung. He then gave her a tour of what looked like a working police station.
Seems like 2-3 policemen working there with a uniform, and one receptionist there with a desk with the police logo. It looks very real to me. That moment, all my suspicion, all my doubt are gone.
But moments later, they were interrupted by a message over the station tannoy ordering Officer Fung to take a call about Helen. Officer Fung put Helen on hold, and when he returned, he said he had been informed that Helen was on their wanted list, suspected of a massive financial fraud.
I said, that's nonsense. I never know anything about that. He said, but that's your passport number. That's your name.
Officer Fung told her if she believed she was being framed, she must help them catch the real crooks. Helen was made to sign a confidentiality agreement, and she was ordered to download an app so the scammers could listen in on what she was doing.
You're not brief a word to your friends, family, to your boss, nothing. If you tell anyone, you're already being interviewed by Chinese police. Your life is in danger.
A few days later, Officer Fung rang back to tell Helen several suspects had now made statements accusing her. There was even a taped confession.
The fake Chinese police, so they sent this video to you?
Yes.
In the video, you see a male suspect, apparently confessing in a police interview room. Helen could barely believe it when she heard the prisoner naming her as his boss in the fraud.
Oh, he just said your name?
Yes. But that moment I was trembling because it's convinced me it's a real case and in deeper, deeper, deeper trouble.
We've taken a closer look at the video, and because the suspect is wearing a large COVID mask, it's impossible to tell if what you're hearing matches his lips. It would be easy to add a fake soundtrack that mentions any name the scammers choose. But Helen had been convinced she was dealing with genuine police, and she believed Officer Fung when he told her that she was going to be extradited to China, even though she's a British citizen.
You've got 24 hours, you pack your bag, everything, police are coming to take you to airport.
This was the moment the scammers had been working up to. Helen was told she could halt her extradition if she paid bail money, so she sent them her life savings of more than $36,000. But a few days later, the fake police were back, demanding even more money, or Helen would be on her way to a jail cell in China. Helen was in despair.
I'm fighting for my life. If I go back to China, I may never come back.
When Helen tried to borrow the money from a friend, he alerted her daughter, who told Helen it was a scam. Helen's story is extraordinary, but far from unique. Chinese embassies have issued warnings about police impersonation scams after a wave of cases around the world. The FBI has also issued alerts in the US. One woman in LA was reportedly tricked out of $3 million. Experts believe that many of these frauds are being run by Chinese criminals operating from countries like Myanmar and Cambodia. And there are worrying signs the scamming industry is learning new tricks. Benedict Hoffman works for the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime.
We're basically seeing scams being done using deepfake videos, people being called by family members or police officers, and basically not able to determine whether that's the real person or not.
Back in London, Helen's bank refunded the money she lost, but she still has nightmares about her ordeal.
I feel a bit stupid right now, but to think about it, there's no chance I can know that's not real. It's so convincing.
Helen Young there, who was talking to our reporter, Elaine Chong. She's only 9 years old, but she's already been hailed for her astonishing talent in chess. Now, British schoolgirl Bodana Sivanandan is set to make history as she's become the youngest player to be selected to represent England internationally. She'll be playing in a chess tournament in the Hungarian capital, Budapest, in September. She's almost 15 years younger than the next youngest teammate. Bodana and her father, Siva, spoke to my colleague, Justin Webb.
My first got interested in, like, 2020 December. One of my dad's friends was going back to India and he had, like, loads of stuff that he had in his house and he gave them all to us. And in one of the bags, there was a chessboard. And I took out the pieces and I unlocked them and I wanted to use them as toys. But instead, my dad said that I could play the game and then I started from there.
Whoa. Dad, Siva, that was a good move.
Yes, yeah. It was COVID time, so I got three kids just to keep her engaged with some activity. She was asking questions, then I said, if you're interested, you can continue. She watched YouTube and other online videos to continue on the chess. Her interest and passion slowly built up and got into the mainstream.
It must have been thrilling, particularly in COVID lockdowns, to see that happening.
In a positive way, this happened during COVID, although many families had their own tough times. She started playing chess and part of exactly 2021 July, which is like 3 years ago, she started playing over the board in Chess Fest. This weekend, there is going to be a massive Chess Fest in London, Trafalgar Square. Mm. So just 3 years and her hard work and the support from the English Chess Federation, people from English chess community, her mentors and coaches, this put her into the right track and she is where she is now.
Has she inherited this from you and your wife?
Not really. We don't play chess at all.
Really? You don't play?
This is completely happened accidentally.
Isn't that extraordinary how that can just happen in a family? You must be thrilled now.
Yeah, we are very happy and glad with the way things are going. We all hope she enjoys playing chess and continues to play in the same level.
Proud father Siva and his very talented daughter Bodna speaking to Justin Webb. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Vladimir Muschetchka and the producer was Rebecca Wood. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.